The best way to predict the future is to invent it. Stephen Ambrose brings you up to speed on what the future holds as he explores the latest technology as it impacts our lives.
Well, welcome to Tech Talk right here on Hi FM. And as we experience the onset, well, the first twinges of winter are coming. We are experiencing a pre-election electricity holiday. We haven't had any load shedding for the last couple of weeks, which is a relief and a wonder, especially for the gadget orientated and those that have anything that plugs into the power. But on that note, part of the reason why we're not, and it's a totally technological reason why we're not having load shedding, according to our friends at Eskom, is that the amount of solar power panels that have been installed has now breached 5.4 gigawatts of power, which is essentially bigger than Kusile, the big, big coal-fired power stations. And generally, South Africa has lots of sun, so the yield is very, very, very high. In fact, if you want to compare the yield of solar panels, it's certainly in the average sort of with a battery backup, you're getting 60, 70, 80% of uptime as opposed to our dear friends at Eskom who are sitting in the mid-50s. So long may it last. Hopefully power cuts become a thing of the past and it allows all of us with our fabulous gadgets and gizmos to just keep powering up and playing and having fun and listening to movies and listening to music, watching movies, doing whatever we need to do. But on that note, some very interesting stuff is happening, unfortunately, in the space and in the online connectivity space right now. Starlink, which we've spoken about quite a bit, and I mean that is Elon Musk's satellite. It's called LEOs, Low Earth Orbit Satellites, which bring connectivity to the most rural parts of the world and pretty much covers everywhere with a really fast and really usable service using a tiny and easy to install and easy to set up dish. And I must tell you, I've tried to use the C-band dishes in really interesting places like in the game reserve, and it is a business to connect them. You need all sorts of equipment to try sight it to a satellite, then it's hit and miss. And the Starlink stuff is just so simple. It's been properly and easily sorted out. But here's the unfortunate bad news. A lot of people in South Africa, for a lot of good reasons, have been using Starlink. They've been buying it from distributors that have got offices in Swaziland or Eswatini, in Mozambique, and bring them into the country on a roaming product. Now, the roaming costs from Starlink are not terrible, so it's not prohibitively expensive. And that allows a Eswatini-registered Starlink portal to connect while it's no longer in that regional area. But technology is quite smart in that regard. Starlink can actually figure out where you are physically based on where your dish is. And they are now saying that at the end of April, that if they will cut everybody off who's operating a foreign or non, there are no South African Starlink dishes, but anything from another country. Sorry, that got a little bit too busy with my mouth. But anyone who's got a Starlink device bought from a third country and is operating in South Africa will be cut off, apart from the ability to connect to Starlink's own website and correct your location or make changes, et cetera, et cetera. And that's going to be a big blow because I know of personally a few people, and I assume there are many thousands out there who've been using it as their primary internet connection. And that is a real problem. There is a somewhat cumbersome solution to this. You've got, in terms of the new regulations that they've announced, you've got 2 months roaming outside of your own area. So if you could physically take the dish and connect in Swaziland or wherever you are for a period of time, your new 2 month start would begin and you could come back to South Africa with your dish, connect it up and continue roaming for 2 months. But that is a terrible solution. And that, to add insult to injury, apparently the price of the Starlink equipment has been slashed in surrounding countries, Botswana, Swaziland and Mozambique, to make them even cheaper to obtain and own. And in many ways, I see this as an absolute pressure game being played by Starlink on South Africa, because the biggest problem with South Africa is they've insisted that Starlink either go through a local empowerment company that is licensed, which is totally not his model, or Starlink itself needs 30% ownership minimum of previously disadvantaged groups in South Africa, which is utterly impossible for a global company like Starlink. There are a lot of companies, international companies, that have found ways around it, but they tend to be companies like Microsoft, HP, people that have got a large physical presence in the country, which makes sense to then run a local operation with all sorts of BEE or triple BEE setups. Whereas Starlink are not. They're a virtual company. They probably don't have offices in many places in the world, and they simply supply services to the world. So it's a really unfortunate situation, and it's a real pity, because I think this is a brilliant service, and it's a service that brings so much value to so many places, especially rural schools, hospitals, and other sort of critical service providers. But on that note, what is interesting, and you know, for every man's poison is another man's opportunity, Secom have climbed into the satellite. Another news release this week, Secom have climbed into the satellite stuff. Now, Secom, if you've not heard of them, are the company, they're a major undersea cable network company. And on that note, quick update. Repairs on some of the cables are ongoing, should be up and running. There's been very little disruption. The wonder of the internet, all these cables have been bypassed, and generally the internet's okay in South Africa. It's not as fast or as capacious as it used to be, but the cables are being repaired. Anyhow, Secom are launching satellite connectivity, and they are working with a satellite service provider, also with LEO or low Earth orbit satellites. They'd love to work with Starlink, but mentioned their problems. But there is an alternative, not quite as ubiquitous, but it's owned by Eutelsat. They also have a very solid low Earth orbit satellite system. And they are unfortunately only aiming it at major service providers or large corporates. That's their business. What I do expect to see happening for those that need it is a number of these service providers, which may well be ISPs, will start on selling the satellite service to their own clients to bring some sort of relief. But overall, it's a real hassle that South Africa has to deal with this type of nonsense around a simple ability to connect. And there are many places where fiber doesn't reach, where there's almost no way that you can get cables or maintain cables or any form of physical infrastructure, including mobile. There are so many areas where satellite just makes perfect sense, and it just adds an enormous ability to connect and to be connected to the internet and to all the various services and platforms that provides. And satellite is now, especially with the low Earth orbit satellites that are growing in popularity, certainly through Eutelsat and through Starlink, and there are others coming on board. There are a lot of other uses for these satellites. For example, some of these satellites, including Intelsat, can allow you to use your normal phone on a satellite. So when you're out of coverage, you'll now be able to connect normally, somewhat lower speed, but certainly normally with both voice calls and data across these platforms. And again, because of the story with our friends at Starlink, probably not going to happen. But there are other platforms that are doing it. So watch this space. I think internet connectivity is certainly a topic that definitely has come to the fore. And one of the other reasons that Secom mentioned is that satellite communications are not affected as badly by power or load shedding. I know I mentioned that load shedding has gone away for a bit, but I doubt very much it's gone away for good. Come the end of May, I expect to see significant load shedding events coming again. So on that note, we're going to have to take a quick break for our sponsors. We'll be back straight after that. And a big announcement from Sony regarding their new range of TVs, and it introduces some interesting wrinkles into that space, which we'll discuss in Tech Talk Cafe straight after this.
This is Tech Talk with Stephen Ambrose on 101.9 High FM.
Moving on to an announcement this week. And it's one of the last announcements post CES in terms of TVs. Now, the announcement was from Sony. Sony have been, I believe, at the forefront of retail TV creation for many, many, many years. Obviously, some of us remember the Trinitrons from way back when, which were some of the first TVs that we ever got to see. Some of us would, you know, date ourselves by saying that, but that's the truth. However, of late, Sony initially used to make a lot of their own LCD panels, and that moved on to them using other people's panels, notably LG's OLED panels, which came to dominate the entire Sony lineup in terms of high-end TVs. And last year's range of Sony TVs were, and I've spent some time with some of them, there are so many, it's impossible to see them all, but the top-end OLED or even the new Samsung-based OLED panels certainly did take television and television brightness and quality to absolutely the next level. When you combine that with the processes and the processing speed of many of the processes, of course, everything's got AI built in. There's no question about that. But simply put, AI in this context simply means that there are very smart, very extensive algorithms that can operate at speed to optimize and perfect pictures. So it recognizes a face, it optimizes what a face should look like based on all sorts of, you know, heuristic type elements and the information that it has, and it removes noise, which is easy to recognize, and generally sharpens up, cleans up, and presents the best possible picture. And this is all happening in a microcomputer on the inside of your TV. Who would have thought that your TV has actually got a processor and a computer and some memory, pretty much like your laptop computer from a few years ago. But that's simply the fact. Then presents that to modern OLED type panels, and they really have got to the point where they are absolutely spectacular. Now, the higher-end QD OLEDs and OLED panels are all what are known as emissive. In other words, every little dot you see or light that you see on the panel is an actual LED that emits directly light to you, either through a lens, which the latest ones have, which helps focus it. But essentially, there's no backlight. Most older LCD TVs had a liquid crystal panel, which was either on or off, and then behind that panel was lighting. Now, they've done a lot of work around creating better lighting. In the early days of LCD, there was simply a fluorescent tube at the bottom shooting light up to the top. So sometimes the bottom of the TV was slightly brighter than the top of the TV. And because the OLEDs never, I mean, not the OLEDs, the liquid crystals were simply liquid crystal in a substrate, like a little piece of glass, never went truly black. So the TVs were fairly gray, even though they did a lot of work to try to create blackness. But the contrasts of standard LCD TVs over the years, even today, tend to be fairly low. Compared to OLED, when the little pixel's off, it's off. It's blackness. Proper, correct, almost infinite blackness, because there's no light coming through the back of the panel, and the little dot that bright lightens up to give you the colors or the light is off. So you get a perfect blackness and you get tremendous sharpness. And that is why OLED has come to dominate. The biggest problem that OLED has got is because each pixel is so tiny and you can only heat it up so much and get so much light output out of it, that they tended to be a lot dimmer than bigger LEDs that were used to light the back of a LCD TV and shine light through little lenses and through the LCD panel itself and create a much brighter, much more exciting experience. But the downside, as I said, was sharpness, because the LCDs weren't quite as numerous as the little pixels in an OLED. And also, you couldn't shut them off completely to create this deep, deep, deep black that OLEDs and QD OLEDs and all the rest, the versions of it, could do. But here is where it gets interesting. The new range of TVs for 2024, which were not announced at CES and are pretty late in the game, LG and Samsung and many others have launched their new TVs. The new ranges of TVs, their top-of-the-line model, the Sony Bravia 9, is not an OLED TV. It is a mini LED TV. And what that means technically, that is, it is in many ways very similar to a LCD TV, except they're using tons and tons of little LEDs to light up behind the panel. And they're talking about 325% more. And because of that, they can get the lighting up to about 4,000 nits. Now, 4,000 nits might not mean anything, but just to give you a comparison, the average OLED, without the new generation OLEDs, the average OLED gets to between 800 and 1,000. Some of them, the new ones from last year, got up to 1,500. And what that does is that in a bright room, if things are really bright, you'll find that the picture starts getting washed out, the light interferes, and there are a couple of ways to deal with it. And this is something that is happening. They put lenses on to direct the light, make it a bit brighter. They cut the reflectivity of the screen enormously to stop the reflections of the light washing out. But brightness against brightness. So you're in a very bright room with a TV that's not that bright, the picture's not going to be as dynamic and as vibrant. With a 4,000 nit mini LED TV, you get enormous brightness, along with simply because there are so many LEDs, which they are using in an OLED style, you're getting almost the exact same sharpness, the right sort of color saturation. And although it's almost academic to have such a bright TV, the other little element that Sony is pushing quite hard in this regard is that, remember that they make a lot of TV programs, they make a lot of movies, they make the cameras and the equipment on which TVs are made. So they really do understand the back end, and they're promoting this whole thing that each one of this TV itself has a special mode. So it's got a Netflix mode, it's got a Prime Video mode, which then emulates the conditions and the type of picture that was designed by the creators of these movies on those platforms. So when you're streaming from Netflix, it will automatically switch into Netflix mode and give you the picture as the creator of the movie intended. So I've glanced at this TV. I've not been able to really spend any time, so I've read a lot of the reviews. But I thought it was really important to understand that for many years, OLED has been the only game in town. And the mini LED TV, Samsung teased a few over the last few years. LG have been using it. They've been using a very similar technology on their big outdoor screens. I don't know if you've seen them. There's a huge one at Sun International in Menlyn. And that is a mini LED type TV because of its sheer brightness, obviously not as sharp and not as portable. These TVs are going to be extremely, extremely expensive to start, but not nearly as expensive, interestingly, as some of the big 4K OLEDs. So I think this is quite a big shift, and I think we're going to see this technology becoming more and more prominent. And along with Sony's ability to process and to manage and to create pictures that for me have always been some of the best on the market, I think this is definitely something that we need to look out for and to understand. But that being said, there was a lot more to that, unfortunately or fortunately. The Bravia 9 8-inch is going to be about 100,000, 85-inch, sorry. It's going to be about 100, 120,000 Rand. Now, that's an obscene amount of money to spend on a TV. However, again, if you can and you want the very, very, very best, this is probably something that is going to become more and more popular, and the prices over the next couple of years are probably going to drop. And they're only bringing that out, from what I can understand, in a 65, 75, and 85-inch version. I'm not sure if the 65 will be worth it, because the difference in price between the 65, the 75, and the 85 is only about $600. And when you're spending $5,000, $600 is not... You know, if you can afford that, I don't think 600 makes a huge difference. But it depends on the size of your environment. But it also, as I said, the new Bravia 9 has all the Dolby Vision, studio calibration modes, everything to do with Netflix and movie or sports programs. And it also can adjust the brightness based on your environment, because if you're in a very dim room, 4,000 nits will burn your eyes out, literally. Just picture this. You've got an 85-inch panel producing 4,000 nits of light at any point in time. So full white would make you actually light up the room better than any amount of lighting that you could supply. So it makes a lot of sense under those circumstances to have a sensor that adjusts the lighting in the room to the actual ambient level, or the lighting of the TV to the ambient level of the light. Also, it's got all the gaming modes and everything that you could possibly need. And their new processor, as I said, is one of their latest ones with the most memory, the most speed, the most processing, and will bring a level of reality to the TV and to the picture that is actually hard to understand. And again, I've looked at some of the older TVs versus some of the newer TVs in terms of processing, and it's not subtle. On both the LG and the Samsung, and now the Sony, the latest generation of processors with their AI functionality, I love that everything's AI, but that's the way of things, certainly does bring crispness and a reality and a clarity to many pictures. And it is most apparent when you look at really complex pictures where you've either got massive contrast, very dark or very bright fronts, with faces and people doing stuff in between that. And you need to be able to move. And then there's horses running or cars moving or people moving. And you see the ability of the processor to constantly update between 50 and 60 frames per second that picture to give you the ultimate sharpness and clarity. And the new processors, and that's more than anything. Often people will say to me, you know, 2022 or 2023 or 2024 model TV, what is the difference? You know, is it that much better? And in truth, the last couple of years, the differences have been fairly subtle. They've been fairly, you know, you need to be a bit of an expert. You've got to have the lighting right. You've got to have the right source of really good quality 4K stream, etc. We won't talk about Blu-ray or anything like that. That seems to have died a death of note, even though Blu-rays today could actually potentially produce pictures that are way better than any streaming service. But that's a topic for another conversation. But right now, the new ultra-bright, ultra-high processing power TVs are distinctly and significantly and visually better than anything I've seen before. There seems to be a significant quantum step in sheer reality. And the problem with a TV of this quality, both the new ones from LG, which are not quite as bright, even though I'll talk about some of the Bravia 8s, which there's a 9, 8, and a 7, and the 8s are OLEDs. But even with those, the 2022 to 2024 leap in TV technology, with 23 being quite a big leap, but now in 24, it's a significant leap, is once you've seen it, it's very hard to unsee. You go back to a 2021 and prior, or even a 2022 panel from top-end TVs, and they suddenly become dim, unsharp, a little bit messy in terms of color. Motion is not as smooth. It's unbelievable how quickly you can see the differences between older TVs and new and the latest generation of TVs. And as I say, the problem with that is that once you've seen the best, good becomes not good enough. And well, that's my problem anyway, but that's probably why I enjoy technology so much. So if you're in the market for a new top-end TV right now, and you're prepared to, you know, give out the money, there are three models that I would look at in the market. The top-end C-series from, or the G-series from LG, the new QD OLEDs from Samsung. And now, just to throw the cat amongst the pigeons, and generally it's always a little bit more expensive than the other two, is the new Bravia 9 series from Sony, which all the reports I've read, and as I said, I've glanced at it briefly at a press meeting, and it is without question one of the sharpest, brightest, best color TV that I have seen for a long, 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 long time. And it is, I'd love to spend some more time with it. I'm going to try to organize one to spend some time and give you a full detailed review. But overall, it excels in absolutely every area, including audio. They've done a lot of work. Nothing beats a soundbar or a hi-fi set, especially on these ultra-thin, and the mini LED TV is not as thin as OLED, but still very slim and very elegant. but a big slab of TV doesn't have a lot of room for decent sound. Although the sound of these look pretty good, they've got subwoofers, they've got some special tweeters and other elements all scattered around to give very interesting sound. What the 9 does not have is the sound coming out of the panel itself like the 8. So let's move on quickly to the 8, because I think that is probably more approachable for most of us. The pricing of the 8s drop considerably, around about half the price of the mini OLEDs, the mini LED TVs. And their 77 inch is going to start off at around about 85,000 Rand. We'll find out the pricing in South Africa shortly. They've just announced them globally and in South Africa. The 65 inch, which is the sweet spot, will be around about 50,000 to 60,000 Rand, which again is not inexpensive, but for a quality TV of that sort, it is really, really reasonably priced, and it competes with the LG C4 and G4 OLEDs as well. So the difference between those and the Bravia 9 is that these are OLED TVs, and they are not the latest Evo panels, but they are certainly some of the brighter ones. They're about 30% brighter than last year's panels, and definitely have an incredible, they use the same processors as their top-end Bravia 9, and they definitely are significantly better. So if you've got, again, any TV sort of 2020 and before, and I know TV should last between 5 and 8 years, but I think today with a move of technology and the pace at which processes and everything move, 3 to 5 years is a long time for a TV. And I suppose you've got to look at the return on investment. You know, 100,000 Rand TV should last a little bit longer than 2 to 3 years. But then again, maybe you've got another bedroom or somewhere else you can move the older one to, and in your main room, you can pick up the latest and the greatest. The difference between even the Bravia 8, never mind the Bravia 9, 2024, and any TV going back to 2021 or thereabouts, or 2022 even, you'll find that there is a significant improvement in picture quality, brightness, processing, and the ability to really generate a very convincing home cinema experience using a really big TV. But the Bravia 8 is much more akin to the standard OLED TVs. It has all the same sort of specs, but it's around about 1,500 nits maximum, and it's definitely brighter and clearer than the others. Moving on just before the break, we'll wrap this up straight hereafter, but the 7 series is a mini LED TV, but on a much lesser scale than the 9 mini LED TVs. So it uses LCD technology with mini LEDs, with localized dimming, and again, the small time that I had to see these new models, it has a very impressive picture quality, but you can see some of the LCD compromises coming through. The blacks are not quite as black. They're pretty good. They're not as bright as the 9 series, but again, really good. But the processing and the quality of the picture is really good. And overall, you'd get used to it, and you'd probably find it's a very satisfying TV. And the pricing, again, is around about half that of the top-end OLED TVs. So obviously you have to do what you have to do or buy what you can, but if you're shooting for the best, the new mini LED TV, the 9 series, the Bravia 9s, without question, will probably be rated as the best TV of 2024, unless there's new stuff coming from someone. And the 8 and the 7 are a little bit more normal, if you want to call it that, or a little bit more mainstream, I think is the best word, and competes very well against Samsung, Sony, and LG, and all the other types out there. So on that note, we'll take a quick break for our sponsors, and we'll be back with an interesting gadget that I've spent a little bit of time with over the last couple of months, and been getting a lot of queries about it. We'll speak about that straight after this.
This is Tech Talk with Stephen Ambrose on 101.9 High FM.
Now, moving on to something that a lot of people have asked me about. And again, we're in a transitional period. I wouldn't say transitional, but we're in a period where there's not a lot of unbelievable stuff happening other than thinner, lighter, better, faster, smarter, brighter, whatever. You know, very much a evolutionary relationship around what's going on. And I've been reviewing an iPhone 15 standard aluminium body, 256G, or gig, if you want to call it that way. Not as so instead of 5G, it's 256G. That would be quite interesting. But no, a 256 gigabyte memory model alongside my iPhone 15 Pro Max for the last couple of months. And there were two reasons for this. The main reason is a lot of people say, is the Pro Max worth it? And the other question that often gets asked is, do you need to spend now upwards of 34,000 Rand on a cell phone when there's one for round about 10,000 Rand cheaper with similar specs running exactly the same operating system for round about 23,000? And if you look around on the various deals in terms of deals from the networks and purchase deals, you can probably get it slightly closer to 20,000 Rand. Now, again, that's a lot of money to spend on a phone. But the iPhone 15 and 15 Plus are based on, call it last year's chip technology and this year's screens and this year's latest operating system. Now, the benefit of iPhone is that it's really, of all the mobile phones on the market, with the exception of a few flagships from Samsung and others, they tend to have the longest longevity and the easiest updatability of devices on the market. Now, June will be the big Apple developer conference, and there's so much talk around iPhone 16 and OS 18. The iPhone operating system 18, which will finally bring AI or smart AI to iPhone devices going forward. Now, iPhone 15, 14, and I think even the 13 have very advanced neural processing units, NPUs, and that was something that they spoke about a lot, and a lot of AI type activity has been going on. But the ChatGPT type AI, which has become prevalent and which Samsung leveraged enormously well in the S24 range recently, and certainly stole the march on everybody with Circle to Search and all the translation and other AI assistance in the photography side, especially in night mode and others, certainly set the S24 aside as one of the coolest and probably the best and most advanced mobile device on the market currently. Apple tend to follow the curve slightly slowly. Their rationale, very simple, is that what they're looking for is the best user experience, and being on the bleeding edge of technology tends to have too many rough edges for the average Apple user. So whether you like it or whether you don't, the iPhone 15 is an aluminium-bodied, light, reasonably priced, and reasonably sized device. It is not spectacularly better than the 14 or the 13, but certainly if you're upgrading from a 12 or a 13, it becomes an incredibly compelling model with regard to what you need. The processor is really, really fast. The optimized iPhone operating system is also very, very fast, incredibly standard and predictable, and just tends to ask a lot less of you than an Android operating system. You get used to both, and the adherents on both sides of the equation that swear by one or the other. But generally, I find iPhone a lot less intrusive, a lot less noisy, a lot more predictable in use. There's a lot more consistency amongst the apps, and you tend to have to tap the screen less to get stuff done. So for some people, they don't mind it and actually love the flexibility of Android. But generally, the iPhones give you a very consistent, very easy, very predictable, and very high quality experience. And the 15 is no different to any of the others. Compared to the Pro Max, the user experience is identical. The screen is almost identical. It is significantly lighter. The only differences really come into the processing speed, which you can't really feel for the types of stuff, unless you're a massive gamer or you do a lot of video files. There is a distinct difference in the camera. The 15 has got an excellent camera, very, very good main camera. The selfie camera is not quite as good as some of the Android competition, but certainly good enough for everything you want to do. So video chats, conferencing, taking selfies, no problem whatsoever. The rear camera is really good, and they've improved the battery life considerably. So to run a whole day with lots of usage was no problem. Topped it up sometimes, very rarely. Most you'd get late into the evening before you needed to plug it in. It charges pretty quickly. Again, not as fast as some of the Android competition, but certainly fast enough for most of us, even using their MagSafe charger, which I use because why not? And it does also come with the new non-Apple charging port. So you can charge it with any USB-C charger pretty much anywhere. And one less cable to worry about. But if you're in the ecosystem, it's a bit of a hassle because all your old Apple charging cables and Apple cables don't work. It works with a lot of other cables. But the MacBook Pro and the iPads have switched across to USB 4. So it really makes, or the USB-C as it's called, it really makes no difference. And there's still lots of charging. Again, a charger is not included in the packaging. So you have to either buy your own or not. It's obviously got 5G and all those sort of features. And the Wi-Fi, I must say, is incredibly fast. So let me wrap this up in a few minutes, and I just want to discuss what's going on, whether you should upgrade, you shouldn't upgrade, and whether with iPhone 16 coming, it's time to do it now or not. But we'll do that straight after this when we have a quick break for our sponsors.
This is Tech Talk with Stephen Ambrose on 101.9 High FM.
Back, and let's just wrap up my iPhone 15 long-term review. It is an outstanding device. It's simple to use. Definitely you need a case. If you drop it, it's not that hardy, it can break. So you always got to add a little case, and there's so many on the market, and it's not a problem. The battery life is great. The performance is outstanding, and it will upgrade to iPhone OS or OS 18 in September of this year, which will bring all the AI stuff you can imagine. Now, Apple have announced that they're working with Google on this. So they're not developing their own AI, which is interesting, but understandable considering the scope and the scale of how much money apparently Google are spending, $1.3 trillion on research in their DeepMind and AI stuff. And between them and OpenAI with Microsoft, there's massive rivalry. And that's brilliant because what that does, it just pushes it so far ahead. And expect with the new OS 18, expect incredibly well thought out, well integrated, and very useful AI functionality. Again, probably focusing on voice translation, on the fly, on the device, security, optimizing of text, that sort of stuff. A lot of work will probably land up being done in the photographic area, which will give you even better pictures, better, ease of use, better manipulation, so many other things that you can do. And in terms of moving towards a smart device that almost predicts, and you don't need to keep opening apps, it'll do so much stuff simply by connecting to the apps on your device. I think we're definitely going to see a massive move in that space with iPhone. And again, for the money, I think this is the sweet spot. The Pro Max has a better camera. It has the latest, fastest processor. And in 2 to 3 years, that might make a difference. But right now, if you're going to look at a 3-year to 4-year, probably a 3-year life of the iPhone, you are going to have no problem with upgrading to the latest technology, getting all the stuff you need through the standard iPhone 18, 19, and possibly even 20 upgrades as they come down. And as I said, 18 is looking to be the biggest upgrade that Apple have ever made to the iOS operating system. So stay tuned. And I would suggest that the iPhone 16 will no doubt be faster, better, smarter, more capacity, you name it. But it will not be on a hardware level that much better than the iPhone 15. And I think the pricing will probably land up going up. So if you want to hang around another month or two, there will definitely be good deals on the iPhone 15, and it will be something that will give you 3 years of solid use. It will take many, many upgrades and allow you to fully explore the AI revolution that's now coming to iPhone as well, and to stay really right up on top of the mobile game in every possible way. It's got all the connectivity, connects to all, you know, at the highest speed. It's got a great camera. Perhaps the Pro Max is slightly better, but is it worth $10,000 for standard type use unless you're a professional? Probably not. It'll work perfectly for Instagram, for taking pictures of the family, whatever you want to do. So my recommendation is an iPhone 15 is probably a 256 gig that I do recommend, because 128 runs out of memory fast in a couple of videos, lots of pictures at high resolution, and you land up running into memory issues and lots of apps. And I think you'll need a little bit more memory for iOS 18 anyway. So my recommendation is that if you're looking for an iPhone upgrade, 14 maybe not worth going to a 15, but anything before 11, 12, 13, now's the time to upgrade to an iPhone 15 at a good price. You'll get a phone that will definitely play with everything that you can possibly want over the next 3 years and give you the experience that you're looking for in a great device at a price which, not cheap, is certainly very mid-range reusable in that space. If you're not an iPhone fan, there are a lot of other options out there, which we've talked about. But if you are an iPhone fan and you love the ecosystem, this is probably one of the sweetest and smartest upgrades, because I do believe that there will be major hardware revisions after the 16, which is coming out in September, because you can't keep going with the exact same phone and minor tweaks and expect people to keep, you know, buying them and changing them, unless you're, of course, an audio or a tech reviewer such as myself. So on that note, I'm afraid we've pretty much run out of time. Just been notified it's time to wrap up, so I will do so. So stay tuned to Chai FM at all times, obviously, but also stay tuned on Thursdays between 11 and 12 to hear all the latest news, gadgets, gizmos, and updates of technologies that really are going to change your life, or at least make it, for me, much better. This is Stephen Ambrose for Tech Talk on Chai FM.